Guardian Podcasts, sponsored by audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/free download, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
Hello, this is Music Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alexis Petridis.
And I'm Kieran Yates.
Coming up, Kieran will be talking to Labyrinth about why grime is such a waste of time. I'm talking bats and glam rock with Turner Prize winner Jeremy Deller. And, as ever, we've got three tracks to listen to in Singles Club. That's all here on Music Weekly from The Guardian. Joining us this week, we have The Guardian's very own Michael Hann. Hello, Michael. What's been going on in the world of music? I think we briefly need to discuss Deadmau5's claim that Madonna was promoting ecstasy at a big rave.
But then Madonna's risible defence, no, I was making reference to a song that was written by someone I didn't actually work with on my last album. Yeah, that's what the crowd took away
well,
from that, isn't it, Madonna?
You know, I have to say that the Deadmau5's line about, he said, he's implying, he said, drugs have kept dance music down for so long. And it's like, I just think that's an insult. Dance music, its roots are about gay people on drugs. Its roots are about gay men in New York on drugs. I would like Deadmau5 to go to a sunrise rave in 1988 with a big loud hailer and tell them they're all doing it wrong and keeping dance music down.
I was also very taken with Deadmau5's continual references to EDM, electronic dance music, which is presumably to differentiate it from swing and flamenco and the various non-electronic
acoustic
forms.
Dance music.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Ludicrous.
Kieran, you actually still go out to clubs and things like that. What do you think about this?
I don't know anything about drug taking in
right.
clubs. It does not happen. Dubstep raves, grime raves, nothing.
Does it not?
No, no, nope.
Is that why they're so moody?
Yes.
Is it really not,
so
a drug? I mean, I don't really know.
Just,
is it not a drug?
It's just a lot of kind of smoking weed, isn't it? That's why it's...
But that is a drug.
It's slow. Yeah, but it's not really, is it?
It's not really.
What's that new drug, Mexi? I've never even... They're inventing drugs now. There's something about Mexi.
And they all sound like discount clothing chains as well, don't they?
It just sounds awful. I was reading a
what
thing
about...
What
does it about, do to you, Alexis?
Just all these drugs, all these modern... All these drugs that young people take. When I was a youngster, you took drugs and it made you want to go and have a night out and party and hug people and you got, you know, can I have a sip of your water, mate, and all those. And it was smashing. Anyway, in the world of diamond-encrusted skulls and unmade beds that is contemporary art, few people are as influenced by pop music as Turner Prize winner Jeremy Deller, the artist who managed to combine acid house and brass bands. He came in to talk to me about the music he loves. What was the first music that really intrigued you?
Well, I can't remember the first, but there are two moments as top of the pops moments, like for all of us. Of people of our age. I was about six and it was to be Slade, Gary Glitter, The Sweet, Bolan, David Bowie, Sparks, Roxy Music, really. It was glam rock.
What was it that intrigued you about that?
Well, I think it was about how it looked as well as how it sounded. And a lot of those glam rock songs, especially like Slade and The Sweet and Gary Glitter, were incredibly simple songs, very memorable. Mm-hmm. And also they looked fantastic.
Yeah.
So that was incredibly appealing for a young person.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would just, every week I'd try and buy a single.
What was the first one you bought, can you remember?
Well, the first one I remember buying, which wasn't the first one I bought, was Wigwam Bam by The Sweet. And I went into the record shop and they actually played it for me on the speaker system with my father standing next to me to make sure this was the one I wanted. And it was totally mortifying because I just wanted to buy it. I didn't want my dad to hear it necessarily because he didn't really understand. So
yeah.
He doesn't understand any music that you have to plug in an instrument to play. So he was. I think he was probably as embarrassed as I was by the whole situation. So I just wanted to buy it and get out and play it at home.
Yeah,
on my little record player.
It's intriguing glam rock, isn't it? Because I always think it's the first moment, really, where music starts aiming itself at six-year-olds in a really direct way. Before that, it's sort of by default. And it's a slightly odd situation, which obviously had a dubious side to it as well, where you get these quite old guys, people that had failed to be successful in the 60s, making this music sort of, you know, as you say, incredibly simplistic and presented in a way that's going to appeal to kids.
It was a sort of futuristic rock and roll music, wasn't it? Because most of those guys had been in 50 bands before and had failed and had terrible singles out in 1966 and so on. As had David Bowie. I mean, he'd been in a number of bands, but he just did it in a slightly more thoughtful way. Mm-hmm. But yes, they were basically playing rock and roll with a sort of drum machine in the background or something, some sort of technology to make it sound a bit shinier for children, effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it worked, obviously.
So glam was your first moment, what was the thing?
Well, I mean, at the same time, I saw Help on TV. Mm-hmm. And I rushed to my mother and said, look, there's this amazing band out called The Beatles. You've got to come see it. This is an amazing film. And this was in like 1973 or two. So they just split up. I had no idea they'd split up. I thought they were a current band. And she said, yes, I know. Here's the record, Help. I bought it whenever, 10 years ago, whatever it was. And so that was another thing. I was quite into The Beatles. I mean, Help as well actually is very much aimed at kids, I think. Mm. Although even and A Hard Day's Night. A lot of those early records by the Beatles about their childhoods and their adolescence.
The first, I suppose, musical project of yours that I came across is Acid Brass.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Why did you do that? I mean, on the most prosaic level, it sounds amazing. I mean, a brass band playing Strings of Life or whatever sounds absolutely incredible. What was your sort of thought behind it? What was your impetus?
Well, it was basically a way to articulate changes in British society through music. That's how it's become, and now I realise that's what it was, really. It's really the story of Britain, he says modestly, in the 20th century, as we go from an industrial culture to a post-industrial culture, but also the relationships between those two cultures and the brass band movement being, of course, an industrial form of music. And Acid House, very much a post-industrial, you know, especially when you think it's made in Detroit, which is probably the first post-industrial town. And then very much enthusiastically taken up by people in the north of England, but, you know, the whole of Britain, but really the north of England was the centre of it in all those towns that had a massive decline in the 80s. So there was that connection, social-industrial connection. And then there's also music, the way that music can translate through forms, and not just as a joke. I mean, there is an absurdity to it, and it is quite funny when you hear it. Mm. But actually, when you see it performed, it works very well, and it's very well received.
Was it easy to find a brass band?
It was very easy to find a brass band. This is what shocked me, how easy it was. I just rang up a brass band. It's called Brass Band World.
It was like a magazine?
Yes. And I rang up the editor and I said, look, I would like a brass band to play some contemporary compositions that are electronic music. I didn't use the words Acid House. I just felt this would just kill the project immediately because the associations are so bad. And he said, oh, ring this guy. He's the manager of Williams Ferry Band, who are currently the top band in the country, and they were. And he might go for it because he's a youngish guy and he's in for the band doing different things. And I did. And the guy said, yeah, all right, we'll give it a go. Come and meet me when I'm next in London. The band are doing a gig. Mm-hmm. Met them. He agreed. We got an arranger to arrange the scores, to make the scores, basically. Mm-hmm. It was very simple when you think. When I think back, and we did it. The budget was £2,000. We did it, which is next to nothing when you should do something like that. So it's very straightforward and really such a pleasurable experience meeting the band and hanging out with the brass band. It was such fun.
You brought in Earl Brutus, Life's Too Long. What was the appeal of Earl Brutus? When did you first see them? Why did you like them so much?
Well, I saw them in 94, I think, or 95, at a point in my life where I thought I'd never see anything again that would amaze me musically. I thought I'd seen it all, really, or heard it all. And I'd heard their name, and I thought, that's a really great name. And I knew their manager, and she said, come and watch this band. You won't believe it. And I thought, well, let's go and watch it. We'll see how it goes. And I didn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. it just blew me away, almost literally, because they used explosives on stage, and there was a fight on stage, drum kit was smashed up, and this is literally in the first 30 seconds of the first song. And then there's a fight between two members of the band, and then they started kissing each other. And then it might have even been this song that was playing. It might have been another one, actually. Life's Too Long. But I just thought, this is incredible. And I knew they were slightly older than me, these guys. But I could tell exactly what music they were into, what Top of the Pops they'd seen. And it was just a bunch of people who were far too old to be in a band, misbehaving. And I just felt there's a real tragedy. Again, there's a real tragedy to them, because they're obviously... all these sort of broken hopes and dreams about rock music were contained in this band and their music and all the references. Well, I felt I just got it. I just understood them as people, even though I didn't really know them, and I got to know them later. But I was in awe of them, and I didn't go anywhere near them after the concert. I just thought, this is the most amazing band. They're made for me, almost. Mm.
One of the things you've brought in is a recording of Bats.
Mm.
Tell us about that.
Well, this is an audio recording of Bats I made when I was in Texas. I just made this film, this 3D film of Bats leaving a cave.
Mm.
And this recording is the one I made outside the cave. And it's towards sunset. It's actually sunset. There's less bats. They're just foraging at this point. They're feeding, which is what some of those sounds of them feeding. And it's not the massing of the bats when they came out. Probably 30 minutes. Minutes previous to this, it would have been hundreds of thousands of bats coming out. It's just white noise, but this is just maybe hundreds or dozens, and it's just the sound of them feeding and moving around and negotiating the space.
What made you do the film in the first place? What made you want to make a 3D film of bats?
Well, I've made a film of bats before, quite poor quality film in a way, I wanted to return with a proper film crew and do it justice, really, and show the bats in 3D and make it a very... I wanted to make it quite an overwhelming experience, both to look at and to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sound you'll hear is taken from a bat recorder. It's called a bat box, and it's recording their frequencies.
So is this stuff the human ear couldn't normally hear?
We can't hear this. I don't know if dogs can hear it. Maybe very young children might be able to hear some of it.
Right.
But it's at frequencies that we, i.e. adults, can't even hope to hear. They live in huge numbers together often, especially in Texas. And so when you see them in this en masse exiting this cave, it's quite an overwhelming, life-affirming sight.
It's life-affirming rather than scary.
Well, if you don't like bats or flying creatures, you shouldn't go there. That would be probably the aversion therapy for anyone, because it is unbelievable. But they don't fly into you. They don't even fly around you, really. They fly above you, about 5 foot above you.
You did a poster. Said, "What would Neil Young do?"
I did.
What was that about?
I think Neil Young is one of those very interesting artists that can really. And when I use the word artist, I mean a recording artist, but also an artist in the widest sense, in that he's quite happy to experiment and show his experimentation, and still take risks and change what he does and work with filmmakers and do concept albums and just do things that are not expected of him and still be interested in the world around him in the way that Bob Dylan isn't, really. It's always unexpected with him. I mean, his next project, for all I know, could be with a choir, it could be electronic music, it could be folk music, it could be heavy metal. I don't know what he's going to do next, and he might not either. So I'm always impressed that he comes out and does this. He did this sort of community rock opera with Green Day about 10 years ago, and he's obsessed with his cars now and stuff. I think he's just great, and he's a great role model for someone, for an artist, visual artist like myself. as I get older, I think, well, that's the kind of career I would like as an artist, the one that he's made for himself.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we talk about the busker that you brought in? Because that's Chuck. the opposite end of the world of music from.
Yes, I mean Chuck. He definitely is. We have a track here. Chuck is someone that a lot of people in London would know because he performs on the South Bank and also in Kingston High Street. I've never seen him in Kingston. I just remember seeing him on the South Bank. And I just always liked his way he interpreted standards. And they basically are standards, a lot of the songs he plays. And I just had the opportunity to do a 12-inch, and I thought I'd do a double A-side with him. So Folsom Prison Blues is on one side. Mm-hmm. And recorded it direct-to-disc, which any audiophile will know it's this old way. I mean, I knew nothing about it. You actually cut the vinyl as you're recording, so you can't do anything. There's no overdubs. And as a result, there's a slight hiss on the record, but I don't know if that's to do with direct-to-disc or not. But
and you put this out as a 12-inch?
It's a 12-inch, very limited edition, but I might do another record with him of other songs and make it into a... Well, do people make CDs anymore? I don't know, some sort of download, I don't know.
Did you put it out yourself? Did you?
It was through something called The Vinyl Factory.
Oh, right, yeah.
Who I think associated with Fonica Records, in the basement of Fonica. And they do very nice vinyl objects, basically, records and double packs with sort of nice artwork and so on. So it was quite a bespoke thing. We only made about 300. But it is available online somewhere, on a SoundCloud somewhere, apparently.
That's where I want to stay. And I let the lonesome whistle blow my blues far away.
That was Alexis talking to Jeremy Deller.
His mid-career retrospective, Joy in People, is on at the Hayward Gallery in London until the 13th of May.
Let's move on to Singles Club. Michael, we'll start with your track. That was Anthony Sheikh Shakir meets BBC from the Honest John's compilation Shangaan Sheikh.
Michael, you brought that in.
I did, largely.
It's a very, very left field choice for you.
Well, I was very stung by Pop Bijou's comments on the thread underneath the podcast a few weeks ago, claiming that all I like is middle aged white men playing guitars. So there you go, Pop Bijou.
I am aware
good
of the work.
Good to have a niche,
work.
Michael.
You are, sorry?
Good to have a niche.
I'm aware of the work of Shangaan Sheikh. I've seen them live, and I have to say, this track actually slightly normalises what they do a little
bit. Yeah, I was very taken, actually. This isn't... I was being a bit facetious there. I was very taken a couple of years ago when the first Shangaan Electro compilation came out on Honest John's. This music I'd never heard of, and clearly most people receiving this album had never heard of, that just sounded absolutely berserk. You know, 180 beats per minute, bringing in electro with traditional South African music, a lot of marimba on there. And now there's a new compilation which is matching the Shangaan Electro artists with Western remixers and DJs and what have you. And yeah, this is the one that sounds most conventionally like a European house track, I would say. Mm-hmm. But I still think it doesn't drain the life out of it. There's something absolutely compelling about it. It makes a really good marriage, actually, in a way that I often think that pairing remixer with someone from another musical culture ends up with some kind of awful, worthy, holier-than-thou... agglomeration of nastiness, but there's a real energy about this and about the whole album. Frankly, I could have picked any track off the album. I think it's a terrific compilation all the way through.
Yeah, I really liked it. I listened to the album actually before I came on and I was like, oh my god, yeah, you're right, it's all got that really percussive, really kind of high energy, fun feel to it, and it's got that real housey stomping bass in it, which is, you know, quite fun. I know it's a bit unfashionable to talk about world music, but it does have that kind of housey world music kind of feel to it.
It's a kind of really interesting kind of micro scene as well. Apparently Shangaan Electro originally just came from the city of Malamweli in Limpopo in South Africa, and there was kind of one entrepreneur behind bringing it to wider notice within South Africa. And they make these videos that are interspersed clips of dancing with clips of people standing around photocopiers, because the idea of office workers standing around photocopiers is still fantastically exciting and alien.
Wow.
In this musical
it's,
culture.
It's one of those brilliant things where if you ever go on sort of the some of the furthest reaches of your Sky Planner or your Freeview Planner or whatever, you get these things that will show, you know, it's like African TV channels.
African chart show.
That will show African chart show, you know, videos from Zimbabwe, and they're always totally off their tits. Mm. It's complete, you know, you sort of think you know a lot about African music in a way, and you see these things that are not stuff that's ever going to get brought to Britain, or, and it's just completely...
Well, I think it's really fascinating, actually, in the way the last 2-3 years, the way African music has become perceived in Britain, not just as about, you know, the descendants of King Sunny Ade and Fela Kuti and what have you. We've finally realised, in our kind of ludicrously colonial-centric way, that it's not all about... Wow, there's fantastic celebrations of local culture. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are thriving pop music scenes. And yeah, I agree with you, Alexis. The best way to see that is to flick through the furthest reach of the Sky Planner.
How's this sort of all key into Afrobeat as a sound?
Yeah, I think that there's been this real shift of thinking of African music as this kind of exotic other. And actually, it's become really accessible in clubs through the medium Afrobeats, even a little bit through kind of bashment and dancehall nights. And then, of course, you know, that great track, I can't remember who was it, by Palance, which was a massive... like
we had that on this on the podcast, I think Dan Hancock.
Yeah, he brought in, it's brilliant, and that was a massive carnival tune, and I think that there's a lot of that. The Afrobeat scene is very much like taking something from that gospel scene and taking something from kind of second generation, you know, church choirs or things that you would have heard from, you know, second, third generations in your family, and then, you know, putting some kind of sometimes a funky house beat to it or something, you know, completely, you know, weird and something you think that would never work. And then suddenly, like, you've got a whole club of people singing along to, you know, African words that they don't know what it, you know, they don't know what it means. And, you know, it's just it's that kind of high energy. It's that really contagious thing that I think that African music does so well, and it's always, I don't know, you always dance to it with a massive smile on your face.
Let's move on. Kieran.
Right, here's my tune.
Close your eyes. So watch you do the Macarena somewhere out by Pasadena. Love a drug that everybody here just trying to get a taste of. You a waste of the space that you take up living. This time around, I'm not kidding. I had an intuition about these women and suspicion. Got me looking at shit different. How a man in my position can't start slipping down these slopes, cause it's all just as a kid, I didn't learn that. But when you were young and you just trying to live your life.
That's Fight the Feeling from the new Mac Miller mixtape featuring Kendrick Lamar and Iman Omari. Kieran, your choice. Tell us about Mac Miller, tell us about Iman Omari, and tell us about Kendrick Lamar.
Okay, so yeah, this is the first track that I've ever brought into the podcast that hasn't been from the UK or outside of London, I think, actually.
Wow.
And I thought that this, yeah, the reason is I just thought this was so interesting. It's really it's just so exciting because these three people are kind of really paving the way, in my opinion, of this really exciting hip-hop sound that's coming out of the US. And I think so much has been written about kind of Young Money, Cash Money, Odd Future Camps, and actually there's something a lot more interesting happening in terms of tying together, you know, very lo-fi productions, R&B influences, and, you know, really looking to soul and jazz. So, yeah, this is why I picked this. It's from the new Mac Miller mixtape, Macadelic, that just dropped a few days ago. And Mac Miller, if you don't know, he's like a 20-year-old rapper from Pittsburgh. He's got a massive following. He had, you know, his album's out at the moment, Frick Park Market, which is named after a market in which he used to work. And it's, you know,
am I right in thinking this is the first... I read somewhere this was like the first independent rap album to top the American charts.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah, well, he's got a massive, massive following. Like, you know, over the past years, one of the breakout songs that he released was called Frozen Pizza and Kool-Aid, which is really representative of his whole thing. He's just kind of talking about being young and, you know, playing with friends, and it's got that whole funness, I guess. And what's interesting about this is that he's joined forces with Kendrick Lamar, who obviously released his mixtape Section 80 last year, and Iman Omari, who is a singer, songwriter, and producer who's also released his mixtape Energy, and does a lot of this kind of interesting electronica, and has made him sound a lot more interesting, and he also sings on the hook. So it's kind of these three people that are really at the top of their game with pushing this kind of sound, and I think that them coming together has been really interesting because there is that layering, but it doesn't sound so dense. It still sounds light, and it still sounds...
It does sound light and airy. I like that. I'll tell you what I like about this and what I don't like about this. I like the rhythm.
Yep.
I like the sort of electronic thing that's going on over the top of it. The stuff that happens at the end of the song is complete. It's completely unnecessary.
Yeah,
no one needs to hear that.
I've got to say, Kieran,
making that, humping noises.
The entire record for me was overshadowed by the last 45 seconds when all the music goes and you just hear a female voice going. I want you to. You can imagine what she wants the person she's talking to do. And she repeats
pick up some bin liners on the way
again
home.
Again and again.
That is the power of hip hop, guys.
The other thing, I mean, let's not be distracted by.
It's hard not to be.
It's very hard not to be distracted by that. But the other thing, when are we going to start with the autotune? I can't have any more autotune. I'm fed up to the back teeth. It's become a gimmick. It's like, you know, people with the.
Well, it's no longer about anything to do with the vocal. It's turning the vocal just into another electronic component of the music, isn't it? And it's a trend that's been going for 4 or 5 years now, and things have their natural lifespan.
It is the na-na-na-19 stutter effect of our era.
But what I think is that because your ear is so trained to hear that kind of Kanye West auto-tune, you immediately hear it and think, oh, that just sounds naff. But what I find interesting is that reclamation of a sound and making it sound a lot more interesting. And like with here, I think that it does. There's something more happening with the production, which kind of gives it something else.
I like this
else.
Thing that you were saying about the sort of lo-fi-ness and that kind of... I think that aspect of it is really interesting. I think the flow of the rapping is really good. It's just, like I said, it's just the 45 minutes of extraneous... 45 seconds, rather, of extraneous...
It felt like 45 minutes.
It felt like hours. It felt like it would never end. It was like... So that's interesting. This is out now.
Yep. So
on the internet.
The Macadelic mixtape is out now, so you can find it on his website and stream it from there. Next up is Alexis's choice.
Listen. She got a wiggle. She got a wiggle that makes me melt. The problem is I don't know if she even likes me.
That's my choice. That's Dexys Midnight Runners, or Dexys, as they now seem to be called. It doesn't seem to be... Midnight Runners doesn't seem to be on the cover of the forthcoming album, Someday I'm Going to Soar, from which this is taken. That's She Got a Wiggle. I brought this in because I think gentlemen of a certain age have a tendency to talk a lot of bollocks about Dexys Midnight Runners, really. I mean, they're a band that is so unbelievably important to some people that it kind of gets a bit... almost like Bob Dylan-ish.
Well, like The Clash, actually.
Like, they're very, very,
there,
actually,
there, there are people who romanticise The Clash, there are people who romanticise Dexys. A few years later, The Smiths.
However, I got sent a press release. I like Dexys myself. I'm of an age to, you know, remember them when they had sort of chart hits and then remember the kind of bizarre reception that their third album, Don't Stand Me Down, got. I got a press release sent through about Dexys' tour, which they're playing in kind of weird places like Whitley Bay and stuff like that. And it said at the bottom of the press release, our advice to our audience is, look good, we will. And I thought, right on, that's brilliant. And it set me off sort of thinking about... Actually, it's sort of a great thing for Dexys to come back now because some of the things that they do or did are totally lacking from music now. This sense that whenever you come back, you've got to have a totally new look, you've got to have a different sound, you've got to push yourself in this kind of way. And I think that's something that's been lost in music. With this track in particular, I think it's really well orchestrated. I think it's a really good song. Lyrics are a bit... but... One of the great sounds in pop music is that thing that Kevin Rowland does where he goes, listen, before he starts singing. Or there's the best one is on This Is What She's Like, where he goes, excuse me, I'm about to express myself. I just love that. It's that sort of sense of like, this is so important.
Well, that's the thing about Dexys, isn't it? What Dexys have always required, is a leap of faith.
Yeah.
What Kevin Rowland does is embarrass you. He puts you in the place where you think, I can't believe someone is doing this stuff. I can't believe someone who's ostensibly a soul singer is singing this strange series of strangled yelps and cries. But that's what he does. The key Dexys document for me is the live version of Until I Believe in My Soul. It was on the projected Passion Review CD that came out a few years ago. A song that is literally about self-flagellation. Because that is what Kevin Rowland does. He's doing it so that you don't have to. I've been thinking about this a lot recently, actually. I went to see Jonathan Richman the other week, and they've got nothing in common, really, Jonathan Richman and Kevin Rowland.
I bet they would both hate to be compared to each other.
Apart from the fact that what they both do is embarrass themselves so that you don't have to be embarrassed, I think. I think that's the thing.
I think it's also just a complete sense of being totally open-hearted. There's this really weird duality with Dexys, because this thing about it's incredibly dressed up, and you're either dressed as a, you know, some sort of gypsy, or you're dressed
or a stevedore.
Or now it seems to be, you know, I don't know what it's like, sort of 1930s Italian gangster.
Yeah.
Or something. And I will say this much. I once saw Kevin Rowland in Debenhams in Brighton, in the Churchill Shopping Centre in Brighton, on a Sunday afternoon buying some mugs in his full Dexys gear. And I thought, this is a proper pop star. It's like you put your gear on to go to Debenhams. That's fantastic. Kieran.
Yeah. yes, guys, I hear you. But there is just something really funny about the kind of the seriousness. Just sonically, there is this real seriousness about when you listen to this, and you feel like, yeah, as you say, he's saying, listen, you know, yeah, this is serious stuff. And then he's talking about a wiggle, which kind of in itself is a funny word for an older man to be talking about and to be saying. And it's, yeah, there is this kind of funniness, and it's really like, is he in on the joke or is he not in on the joke? And
it's very difficult to tell. I was watching this morning as part of thinking about it. I was watching the video for the full 13-minute version of This Is What She's Like. And it's really difficult to work out if it's meant to be funny or not, because some of it is just ridiculous. I mean, it's an amazing song. I mean, it is, Cards on the Table, I think it's one of the greatest songs ever written, This Is What She's Like by Dexys. But there's bits of the video, there's one bit where he sort of goes into this big singing thing, stood on his own on a sort of street corner in New York, wearing a suit. It's just a bizarre thing. I don't know whether it's meant to be serious.
Don't think I think it is all completely serious. And I think it's all part of the, look how far I am putting myself out here. This is how much I'm willing to bare my soul. I'm willing to be an idiot. I know you all think I'm an idiot for doing this, and I don't care, because this is what's in my heart.
When you have that kind of, you know, when you're seeing yourself so seriously, it makes it more difficult for you to say lyrics like, I want to find a way to make her love me, because suddenly it becomes just a little bit creepy, and, you know, that kind of, you know, serious desperation.
That's fair enough, actually.
Whereas what we were talking about that funny kind of Usher Drake type thing, they can say those kind of things about girls because it feels very playful and it feels very comic and it feels like you could sing that in a club, whereas
I can imagine Kevin Rowland, we're imagining a young Kevin Rowland here, an 18-year-old Kevin Rowland, being the person who makes all the girls at the party feel intensely uncomfortable. He's one who's got them cornered and is hectoring them about what he believes loves to be. I have no problem with that either at all. And I agree there is a strange, right through Dexys, I think there's a kind of strange almost stalkeriness about them.
Absolutely. I think that's really true. However, it's interesting you say that you sort of think it's someone like Drake is kind of, it's playful and it's this, that and the other. Because I find Drake's record really creepy and unpleasant.
Really?
I think the persona that he projects, I think it's fascinating. I think the persona that he projects is enormously dislikable, seems quite misogynistic, you know, and that's a fascinating thing to do. I don't know whether he's doing it, consciously or not, or if he thinks it's actually a bit cool or whatever. But I find that, I mean, I totally see what you're saying about this being creepy, but I find something like Drake, really creepy.
Because when you think about Drake, who really came out of an environment which was after Kanye West, he was so pretentious and took himself so seriously. Mm-hmm. I think that, comparatively, Drake is a lot easier to kind of take with a pinch of salt.
Is Kanye West the Kevin Rowland of hip-hop? That's a really good...
I also want to give a shout-out, because also out right now is an album by Pete Williams, who is Kevin Rowland's sidekick in Dexys. And if you like Dexys, you will like Pete Williams' solo album, which sounds very, very similar to how Dexys sound now.
That's She Got a Wiggle by Dexys, Midnight Runners, from the forthcoming album. I think it's out in May, I'm not sure, which is called Someday I'll Soar. Okay, time for a trawl through our blog and some of your thoughts on last week's podcast.
God, I love mixtapes, says Dave Portivo. I've always wondered why rock bands don't do them. Honestly, why on earth are the Vaccines or Viva Brother putting out albums? They have some nice singles, the Vaccines, not Brother, but the rest of their music is just wishy-washy mix that isn't tied together thematically in any interesting way. Why not just throw it out there, especially when so many indie bands consciously avoid sounding polished?
That's actually a very good point. That's quite interesting. He adds, I better read this bit out. Welcome aboard, Kieran. Glad she joined permanently, as she'll definitely broaden the selection of tracks and keep Alexis on his toes.
Yes, I will. Rob Bufford was temporarily incensed by last week's show. I had to laugh. I read the headline and somehow got it into my head that you were going to link hip-hop mixtapes with the American Civil War. I was genuinely outraged for about 10 seconds. Nice podcast, though, guys. Keep it up.
And finally, Pop Bijou chipped in. The Civil Wars interview. Again, Becky, what is this? The Kieran Love? Have you been sat? Giving yourself loads of different names.
My mum. Yeah.
Poppy Juki, the Civil Wars interview was the best band interview ever from the podcast. I think you're forgetting my backstage tete-a-tete with tongue, mate. But the Civil Wars interview was the best band interview ever from the podcast. How refreshingly honest they came across as lovely people. Happy for their success. Nice one. Yeah, keep them coming in. Comments, as you know, you can leave us your thoughts at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly, or you can tweet us at musicweeklypod. Timothy McKenzie, otherwise known as songwriter and producer Labyrinth. Kieran, you went to meet him.
Yes.
He is, for the benefit of anyone who doesn't know, one of the architects, it's fair to say, of the pop rap sound currently in vogue, right?
It was interesting to talk to him, because I think a lot of the time when you speak to a lot of rappers that have made the crossover, people like Tiny Temper and Chipmunk and Skepta, they've all really come from the grime scene, and they have a real love for grime, and they, you know, they reference it when they can, and, you know, they play at kind of grime parties, at Eskimo Dance, at these kind of things, whereas Labyrinth is really outside of that trend. He kind of doesn't have the same love of grime. He kind of actively tries to distance himself from the sound. His music is a lot slicker. He kind of wants something a lot more in the pass out frisky camp rather.
These are the
than
two tracks, the two famous tracks that he produced with Tiny Temper. He's also worked with Professor Green, Wretch 3-2.
He began by telling me why grime was such a turn off for him.
Labyrinth, come in.
I love so many different styles of music, and I love infusing sounds. Like, and I felt like grime didn't care about what came before it. It was just very young. Like, well, that's how teenagers are. We're just like, I don't care about my parents' generation. I don't care about what happened before this. This is our generation. This is what we do. And I think I did love the idea of it, but I thought, like, it was uneducated musically. Like, they didn't really understand how to make a record. And I was just like, I think my manager definitely inspired my mentality, like the way I was thinking at the time. And he saw that I loved music, and then he just kind of fed that attitude. And he was just like, just be more open. He talked about 360, understand. 360 was understanding your craft the whole way around. Like, so understanding sound engineering, understanding how to produce a record, how to write a record, understanding the chords and the scales and stuff like that. And I'd done a lot of studying after he played me, like George Benson, Coltrane, all these guys. And I was like, I'm not ready, man, if I can't understand my craft. And I think, I wouldn't say Pass Out as a genius record or anything like that. It was just like, I wanted to add a bit more character into what I saw was grime. Like,
it's okay, I'm good. Let's go! Stars out. We bring the women and the cars and the cards out. Let's have a toast, a celebration, get a glass out. And we can do this until we pass out.
There's definitely this sense that, like, what the music that you make is different in terms of, you know, it doesn't sound like grime. Yeah. It's kind of bedroom produced. You couldn't make a Labyrinth tune in your bedroom.
Yeah. I did want it to have a bit of a bedroom energy, like, and then also while doing that, I wanted to have some of my own character in terms of using Super Nintendo sounds. For me, that was just like bringing some of, you know, almost like, you know, if somebody heard my beat, it would be like walking into my room and seeing all the posters on my wall, and you would see a bit of Mario Kart, then you'll see Bob Marley on the wall, and then you'll see, like, you know what I mean? You'll see a dubstep producer, and it would just, it's just like a collage of what my life was like at the time.
So many urban artists that are influenced by computer games. DEE, yeah. Gamma, Labyrinth.
I love it.
Just a Mario Kart generation.
It really is. Of course, I grew up on it. And I remember when we used to be playing like Mario and Street Fighter, and my mum would be shouting at my friend, come and wash the dishes, come and wash the dishes. And we just wouldn't be listening. We'd just be on, like, I don't know, in Star World on Super Mario. and then she would just come in the room and just press the power on the console, and I used to be like, I don't know how you could cry over those things, but at the time I could.
but did you kind of use those tools to make music? Because obviously one of the most famous examples, I guess, is Screamin' Benga, who are making beats on their PlayStation and all that kind of thing. Was that you, or did that come a little bit later for you? Were you kind of doing
In terms of what I used?
Yeah, making beats. Was it on keyboards? Or
do you know it's wild? Because I'm from two different generations. My family is from church, so there's so many musicians in church. There's so many singers. So you can learn so much in terms of music. And then on the other side, I had my brother producing. So I learned how to program and how to be more creative on the production side. And I think because of those two different worlds, I kind of found a way of joining them together personally for myself. I was using like the MPC when I was 13. I was using Cubase, Logic, stuff like that when I was really young. And I was like recording like 40-year-olds and telling them how to harmonize and stuff like that when I was like 13, 14 years old. So for me, it was more of, I think I had more of a thirst for it because everything was around me. I had my older brothers coming in with basses and guitars, and I was just like, I need to play, I need to be on their level. So I think that inspired me to be a little bit more kind of educated in terms of my instruments or in terms of music.
Do you think that sort of awareness, that kind of musical education that you gave yourself, really helped you make the transition into a really mainstream label like Psycho?
I would say it definitely done some justice. I had to do a lot of learning. I think my manager played a big part in turning what I had, all my skills, into something that was kind of tangible. I was just a young kid from church, from the grime scene, from urban scene, from all this. And I'm just inspired and I'm just excited and I'm making all these records. But I don't know which one is which. I don't know how to construct a real pop record. I didn't understand anything. All I knew was to just make what was in my head. And then my manager, I think, helped me understand the way the industry works and the way music translates to different people. I didn't know anything about the club at that time. I was in the studio for so long that, I didn't understand social music, if you put it like that. I had all the tools, and all I needed was just someone to kind of help me understand how to construct them or put them into the right places. And I think as I started to develop and started to learn about the industry a bit more and go out and check the scene, I think I got it very quickly because I just understood all the sounds that were going on, all the vibes that were going on. So it was easier for me to approach them.
And that was a massive moment, wasn't it? It was a massive moment in terms of kind of getting this urban music recognition in the mainstream and pop. You know, it was like, I remember reading like, oh my God, Simon Cowell signed Labyrinth.
It was well. The thing is, because of all the hype that was going on at the time, Pass Out came out, Frisky came out. Everybody was really excited about the records. Labels had met me before through my publishing deal and knew about what I could do. So they wanted to sign me as an artist after hearing me on Pass Out. And then Simon kind of heard about me and asked me to come down and have a meeting because he wanted.
How was that when when you got that call?
And when I got that call, I was just like, wow, things are moving. Like, I was like, you know, I don't know, didn't know what else to say. Like, I was just like, okay. It's coming.
Were you like
up
an X Factor Pop Idol fan before then, kind of?
I wouldn't say I was a big fan. I got to be honest. I did love seeing some of the terrible auditions where people done some absolute silliness. Like you would think, where does this person come from? What planet? But I've got to be honest. I did enjoy that. But it was nice seeing artists getting their chance. People like Leona Lewis. I knew her from ages ago. She used to sing in like some of the same places I sung in. So it was nice to see that she got her break through something like that. But of course, everybody knew Mr. Simon was the big man on the block and he was doing some really big things. And yeah, he heard my record when I went down to his office and he was like, your demos, who's singing on your demos? And I was like, I am. And he was like, you're an artist, man. What's going on? Like, look at the way you dress. You've got it all. Like, what's going on? And I was like, I'm about to be signed. And he was like, well, are you signed? And I was like, no. And he goes, okay, well, I think we better put an offer in. And then it kicked off from there.
It's kind of interesting because obviously your aesthetic and the way you come across, you know, there isn't what, I don't know, what people would see a lot of the time as an intimidating grime aesthetic, you know. Think that, you know, I think something about you, which I think works really well in the pop world, is the fact that you are quirky and you're a bit weird and you are like elephants on trampolines in your videos. And, you know, is that your own creative eye? Or
it was a big thing for me to be an artist. You know, I'm from the urban scene, but I don't need to just be urban. I don't just need to be one style of artist or person. And I remember my manager playing me people like David Bowie and Prince, and the way they approached the industry was that they created their own little worlds. It was like they were, in their own little boxes. And I really loved the idea of that. Like people like Parliament and Funkadelic, George Clinton, they all created their own scenes. It was so theatric, you know what I mean? And I felt like, why can't we be that way? Like, why can't we do something like that? Of course, I'm not as extreme and as wild as those guys. And you never know.
There's a sense of theatre about you.
But you never know. You never know. I might get a bit more crazy as I get older. And as I get a bit more confident, but I think that definitely inspired that energy to want to be a bit bigger than just a leather jacket and some dark shades.
But is there kind of a sense of you wanting to return to a little bit of an underground sound, like, you know, having dubstep remixes or, you know?
It's scary, you know. The further you go away from that island, the harder it's to go back sometimes for some people. And I've seen a lot of urban artists kind of go a bit further away from there and lose kind of some of their respect. But for me, I never classed myself as an urban artist, being honest. I kind of saw myself just as a person that loves music. And I wanted to be that guy that can be in any scene. Like, almost if you look at all these styles as religions, I would be that guy that was just like, I don't know, one day I could be a Christian, the next day I could be Muslim. I just believe in God. I don't believe in any style or any vibe. I just do what I do. And I think that's what I wanted to do with my album. That's what I wanted to do as an artist, is when I perform on stage, I could be a soul man, I could be a rock star, I could be a dubstep DJ, all at the same time, and it wouldn't matter.
That was Labyrinth. His album Electronic Earth is out on Monday. That's it for this week. Thanks to Michael for abandoning his post to come and see us.
Let us know your thoughts at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly.
Thanks for listening.
Guardian Podcasts, sponsored by audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/free download, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.